With sports car racing news and analysis from around the globe, this is the Double Stint Podcast. Here's Ryan Marine and Dan Lloyd.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Double Stint, Sports Car 365's weekly sports car racing podcast at Gate F26 at Chicago O'Hare International Airport, traveling back from Austin, Texas. I'm Ryan Marine. We've got Dan Lloyd on the show here this week, and he's joining us from his car in the UK. How are you doing, Dan?
I'm very well, thank you, Ryan. Some an unusual place to do the broadcast, but nonetheless, plenty of news to get through and lots of racing last weekend as well.
That's right. So we'll dive into that here in just a moment. We'll start with a quick look back at the season opener for VLN. Dan had our coverage writing the recap for that, and he'll take us through the salient points of that event. We've got plenty of news to discuss, including an update to the Le Mans entry list, also WRT announcing its driver lineups, and a whole lot more. A great interview with Patrick Lindsay, who finished on the podium in GTE-M at the 1,000-mile race for the WEC at Sebring, which was quite remarkable considering his car effectively burned to the ground less than a week before that race, and had a chance to chat with him about the recovery process, what it took to get the spare chassis on the grounds, plus in his team ownership role with Park Place Motorsports. That team has really expanded, adding SRO America as well as Michelin Pilot Challenge to their roster, and in addition to Porsche GT3 Cup, as we've seen in previous years. And also, Park Place will be running one of the Porsche factory lineups at the upcoming California 8 Hours. So a whole lot of ground to cover with Patrick, and we'll do that in a little while. And we'll wrap up the show with listener questions and a look ahead to the California 8 Hours to wrap things up. But we'll start with VLN, Dan. And it might have got off to a slower start and a later start than we expected. We can touch on that in a moment, but in the end, it was a pretty thrilling race to the finish with a last lap pass ultimately determining the winner.
It really was, yeah. John Edwards came back after losing the lead to Patrick Pillet in the one of the Manthei Racing Porsches. Edwards in the Rover Racing BMW M6 GT3. He was defending from Pillet on the main straight, the Dottinger-Höhe, that huge straight at the tail end of the 16-mile Nürburgring lap, was overtaken by the Porsche, but he stuck with it and managed to make a move down by the carousel, actually, on the final lap of the race. It was a very, very interesting VLN season opener. We had a 25-car GT3 grid in amongst a whopping 171-car grid in total, the sort of craziness you'd expect from this fantastic little series. And it was a slightly condensed start to the season. The race was supposed to be 4 hours long. It was reduced to a 2-hour, 45-minute duration because we had some heavy fog early in the morning descending over the Eifel Mountains, and that meant that the whole schedule was pushed back 3 or 4 hours. But when the racing did get underway, it was fantastic. We saw some great overtaking, especially in amongst the BMWs and Porsches, which seemed to be the more competitive cars at the head of the field over the Audis and Mercedes. This was a really successful weekend for Rover. They managed to finish first and third, both their BMWs on the podium, and also they had the pole position time in qualifying from Tom Blomqvist. So the Rover cars were really, really impressive. But yeah, the number 99 BMW was the one that started fourth behind the sister number 98 car, and that sort of gradually worked its way through the field. It seemed to have better mileage than the other cars, constantly on each of its stints eking out an extra lap of the Nürburgring Nordschleife on its opponents, and that enabled it to have a sort of shorter final pit stop, which I think really helped contribute its push up into the top places. And then Edwards did the rest in a thrilling final two lap battle with Patrick Pillet. But the race was a great start to the season, and you know, VLN is a really unique championship, and we don't get to see these kinds of cars competing on such an extreme track all the time, which I think is their natural habitat, really. The Nordschleife is just such a superb circuit for these cars. And also in amongst them, the plethora of other classes with touring cars. You've got TCRs, there's the famous Foxtail Opel Manta in there as well. It's such a brilliant grid, and it was a great way to start the season and set a precedent for what we might expect to see in the Nürburgring 24 hours later this year.
Yeah, it's always interesting to see which kinds of cars, which teams, which drivers show up, not just in the top class, but all throughout the field, which is massive as always. I was curious, too, about what we might have learned in terms of the pecking order looking ahead to the 24-hour race at the Nürburgring later in the summer. I think a lot of us will tune in to some of these VLN races in large part because they serve as a precursor to that. We see some factory involvement. We can kind of judge to some degree what the strengths and weaknesses of the various teams and manufacturers might be. What do you think we learned? Is there anything we can take away this early and with this many months in advance of the 24-hour race?
It's hard to say, especially from the race we just saw, because it essentially became a long-form sprint race rather than the four-hour enduro it was supposed to be because of the weather. It's always difficult to make predictions this early in the season, of course, but I must say I was really impressed with the BMW M6s out there. Not just the Rover team, the Falcon Horse cars got a 1-2 in Pro-Am, and the Falcon machine was also really high up there as well, along with the Falcon and Manthei Porsches. Audi and Mercedes didn't seem to have as much pace. There were a couple of the pro runners from each of those manufacturers milling about in the top five. The Mannfilter HTP Mercedes led for a portion, but I think that was only because of where it stood in the pit cycle. But yeah, really, at the moment, what I can see, the standout was definitely in the BMW and Porsche camps.
There was some discussion, I believe, going into the race from at least one team boss about a recent BOP change and how that might have had an adverse effect on safety. What do you think, first of all? Could you summarize that viewpoint, and did we see any of that actually in action?
Yes, so we had two prominent long-standing VLN teams, WTM, which runs a Ferrari 488 GT3, and Fricadelli Racing, which runs a pair of Porsche 911 GT3Rs. Both of those teams publicly expressed their disappointment at a balance of performance change issued very shortly before the event, which basically slowed the GT3 cars down by about 25 horsepower, which is roughly 5% of their total power output, which would have made them brought them down a speed to the same level as some of the slower cars in other classes on the straights. And the main consternation that was stirred up with these two teams was that drivers would therefore be taking more risk in the corners, because that was really the only place where they had a speed advantage over, say, the GT4 cars. Yeah, they were both very disappointed in that, and WTM's actually withdrawn from the series altogether. They didn't race last weekend. Fricadelli did race, but the team said that if there isn't a change to the BOP procedure, they'll be out after the Nürburgring 24 hours. So quite serious times. It seems to be threats of an exodus. It's certainly not what a series would want to hear just before the first race of the season. I can see why the change was made, and it's a very obvious reason. It's on grounds of safety. Nordschleife is obviously an extremely dangerous circuit, and we have had serious accidents there in the last few years. And the appeal of the VLN, really, it lies in its stark variety, which I alluded to earlier, with all the different classes running around. And, of course, measures do need to be put in place to ensure safety there. Is it right to simply cap the GT3 car's power when the straights are probably the safest place for them to get past anyway? I don't know. I can see why the teams are annoyed. Then again, I can see why the measure was put in place. So it's a difficult one. I'm aware that there was quite a large accident, actually, during Saturday's race. Nobody was hurt, thankfully, but there was a Volkswagen Jetta which managed to flip over in the forest section. And it was around one of the corners from the video I've seen. Listeners may have also been aware of this. There were a couple of GT3 cars, including one of the Rover BMWs, right behind it. I don't know if it was to do with the GT cars being quicker in the cornering sections. They were just behind. It's hard to tell for sure. The teams have raised a very serious point in that the safety of the cars is now being compromised. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how the series responds, because it's certainly not a good thing when two of your most established teams are crying out foul some of the procedures that are going on.
Anything else stand out to you from VLN Race 1 of 2019?
No, other than that the weather did clear up quite nicely after the fog. It turned out to be a lovely race, but a great start to the season with the racing that we saw.
Well, Dan's full recap can be found at sportscar365.com if that wasn't enough for you, and we'll have more VLN coverage, of course, throughout the course of the season. Let's take a quick break, and on the other side, we've got plenty of news to dive into from the world of sports car racing. That's next on Double Stint.
Hi, this is Renger van der Zande. You're listening to Sports Car 365 Double Stint Podcast.
Back on Double Stint now. Let's talk some news here, Dan. We'll start with the Le Mans entry list, which has undergone a change since we last discussed it here on the program. We'll start with Spirit of Race opting to bow out with its ELMS car. That has allowed the first alternate to get in, and that is Duquesne with an LMP2 entry.
Yeah, that's right. On the face of it, this does sort of seem like a Ferrari just gets replaced by Orica. We're not really gaining any more variety in the field necessarily with this switch. But I think it's great to see Duquesne in the field, actually. Nothing against Spirit of Race. They've got the ELMS program they've had there with that 55 car has been outstanding, and a very entertaining team. But I'm really happy to see Duquesne in the field. A French squad, fairly new to the LMP2 environment. They had a cracking season last year. They didn't finish too high in the standings. They managed to get into the podium positions on a couple of occasions and were showing some real pace with their Arca 07 Gibson. So great to see them there. And it's a fantastic lineup, in my opinion. You've got Romain Dumas, who, of course, needs no introduction to the Le Mans faithful. And you've also got French drivers Pierre Rague and Nico Jaman, who, as a whole, as a trio, can be an extremely quick proposition. And, you know, I think they could even worry some of the full-season World Endurance Championship teams.
Yeah, so that should be a team to keep an eye on, certainly when we get to the 24 Hours of Le Mans. Speaking of the entry list, that has been in the news for a couple of reasons, and John had a story about the ACO potentially evaluating its Le Mans entry procedure, the possibility of expanding the grid as well. I'm sure you had a chance to read that story, Dan. What were your takeaways from what's been discussed, especially in light of some of the controversy in recent years concerning the entry list for Le Mans?
So, yeah, the Le Mans entry procedure, as you said, Ryan, has been a topic of discussion for the last week, 2 weeks or so. The ACO looking to change things for future editions, possibly expanding the pit garage complex, because we are due to have a new pit complex for 2023. I would say that's sort of the correct decision the correct direction to go in. Also, having fewer automatic entries might be a way forward, because there are a lot of teams that want to do Le Mans and it doesn't necessarily fit into a full season plan that they have elsewhere. I'm looking at sort of some inter-privateer teams. I think the Michael Shank Racing operation would be an obvious one for that. I'm personally all for more random entries to Le Mans. I remember when I was sort of growing up on the race, and you'd have some strange entries in there. Like, you remember the Morgans and the TVRs and sorts of private entries coming in. I would love to see a bit more of that, and from teams that you don't always see in the full season circuits. And I think that would add a real buzz to the race. That's for sure. The automatic invitations, I don't see any problem with the automatic invitations that are currently on offer. Certainly, having one for sort of every class in every series does seem a tad too much, maybe. Should LMP3 carry automatic entries to LMP2 the following year? That's debatable. I'm not too sure if that's the right direction to go in. But yeah, certainly a lot of food for thought for the ACO, and certainly it's good to see that they're willing to assess how the entry situation was this year and where they can improve things to create a better product, not just for the fans, but also for the teams and sponsors hoping to take part.
You can find our full story by John DeGuise at sportscar365.com if you'd like more, including some quotes from Vincent Bomesnil and some other of the people in charge in that story. So we'd urge you to check that out if you'd like more information there. Speaking of entry lists and the WEC, we got another one to talk about here with the Spa round coming up next on the calendar. And we've got, 35 cars on the entry list for the next round at Spa. Is that right?
Spot on, yeah. 35 cars. We've got some cars returning, which we saw at the Spa race last year. And the most notable one for that is the number 26 G-Drive Racing Orica, which actually won the race last year as a guest entry. That was the European Le Mans Series champion from 2018. And that car, run by the TDS squad once again, that'll have Roman Rusinov, Jean-Éric Vergne, the Formula E champion, and Job van Uytte, who's a very promising young Dutch driver who wowed us in LMP3 last year. That's a really exciting lineup. And another car on Dunlop tyres, I think that makes it even, actually, in the ratio of Dunlop to Michelin runners in LMP2. So, yeah, really exciting there. TDS, in its full-season WEC car, WEC car, has also brought in Norman Nahto, himself a former GP2 Formula 2 racer. He made his Le Mans debut last year. He's coming in to replace Loic Duval, who is tied up with the DTM season opener at Hockenheim, which is on the same weekend. We've got so many championships operating on that weekend, the first weekend in May. Interestingly, Duval did a sort of double duty last year when he managed to get a helicopter over from Hockenheim to Spa and was able to compete in both, but perhaps the constraints were a bit too tight for that edition. And this year TDS has gone for Nahto, who himself is a highly capable racer and will no doubt gel into that lineup very well. But yeah, it's a good looking entry list by Colles back in LMP1. Good to see them there with their Enso CLMP101 Gibson. They've moved over from the turbocharged Nissan unit to the Gibson that you'll find in the Rebellions and the Dragonspeed BR1. So yes, plenty of entries to mull over, and it should be, as it always is at Spa, a brilliant spectacle, because in my opinion that's one of the best circuits to see these kind of cars racing on.
A couple of other notes to put in the news section. Some driver lineup news from SRO Championships, including WRT announcing some drivers.
Yes, WRT had its start of season announcement earlier in the week. The Belgian team, the Vincent Voss-led operation, adding DTM to its roster this year, but it also had to present its GT3 programs, which obviously revolve around the Blancpain GT series in Europe. They'll have three Evos in the endurance lineup. You can read the full story with all the lineups on Sportscar 365. Jack Shaw had the story there. But I think the main one to look at is the Dries Van Thor, Ezequiel Perez Compank and Alex Riberas car, which is probably the lead entry out of the WRT cars. It's the only one in the pro category. And for me, that's a real exciting lineup because you've got some great young drivers there, most notably Van Thor, who's going to be, it's sort of a coming of age moment, I think, for him. He's had a really good last year with WRT, sort of elevating himself from just being Lawrence's brother to being a really successful, fully fledged GT driver in his own right. And I think he's going to be able to show something there in that main lineup with Compank, who's been terrific in the Grasser Lamborghinis recently, and Riberas, who made his debut with the team just last year. So it's going to be a competitive lineup, I think. Slightly fewer pro endurance car than last year for WRT, but nonetheless, I think we can still expect that team to be fighting near the front.
A couple of other news items just to touch on briefly. Jeff Siegel has announced that he'll be racing with JMW in ELMS. It's a name that's familiar to sports car racing fans stateside, so cool to see Jeff get that opportunity. And also, over the weekend, Aston Martin picked up something of a historic win, its first win in Super Taikyu, and you can read more about that in our weekly racing roundup, which appears every Monday at sportscar365.com. With that, let's get a break in here. On the other side, we'll talk to Patrick Lindsay about Sebring, about team ownership, and a whole lot more next on Double Stint.
I'm Lawson Ashenbach. You're listening to Sportscar 365's Double Stint podcast.
Patrick Lindsay joining us now on the Double Stint podcast. A busy guy, in addition to, of course, his driving duties and all the business activities and ventures that he's involved in. The team ownership role with Park Place Motorsports continues to grow. But, Patrick, let's start with what you were doing in the cockpit here recently, going back to the Sebring weekend, racing, of course, in the WEC event. You came into the weekend as the leaders in the GTEM point standings and came away with another podium. Overall, how would you characterize the outing at Sebring?
Yeah, so from the WEC side of things, of course, with Project One, it was a good surprise. And when I say that, I mean the circumstances in which we started the race week. As you know, we're pretty dark, emotionally dark. Fiery comes to mind, light from fire. Of course, it was well circulated. Obviously, you guys picked it up. There was a pretty bad fire in the second test day, early in the second test day, with our WEC Porsche RSR. And the Project One guys basically jumped right on it and got the backup car, if you will, coming straight from Germany. I think that car arrived late in Atlanta Tuesday night, showed up maybe 8 a.m. on Wednesday. They made it through scrutineering and just began the process of changing things over. So to go from that beginning to a third place podium and an extension of our points lead, you know, the following weekend or, you know, Friday night, that is a pretty incredible story. And I'm super proud of those guys. They certainly deserve all the glory. You know, we drove the car, and I was happy with the drive. That RSR is obviously a beast, and it was fun to take around the track. But, man, the spotlight definitely goes to the crew.
Yeah, let's kind of take us through all the logistics that were involved. It's just monumental, the task of trying to source another chassis. And I'm curious, too, how it came down did you search around in North America to see if there was an option? And ultimately, when you settled on the one that you had to fly over from Germany, take us through all the different logistical hurdles that were in place just to have a car for you to compete in come Friday night.
So the big question is, you know, where did we get the car from? Well, that fortunately was an easy thing because my co-driver, Egidio Perfetti, had another RSR that was going to be campaigned as an ELMS car over in Europe. So that part of the equation was done, then became the task of, all right, how do we get it on a plane and get it over, clear customs to the point where we can make, it was actually the night practice that we were concerned with on Wednesday night because mandatory, you know, drivers have to get their night laps in. So fortunately the car was there. The Project One crew from across the pond began the process of getting it to the airport. DHL came into play. Of course, they sponsor the series, but they're a logistical partner. So they jumped into motion, created, you know, all the necessary paperwork to get the thing over, the flight and all that. And then, of course, aided with the kind of expediting process through customs when it came into the state. So that was all very well orchestrated, I would say. And it went way more seamlessly than I would have ever hoped or anyone could have ever hoped. Because as we all know, if we shipped anything here for us previous race cars, generally sits in customs for at least a couple of days. So they got that expedited through. So we were able to make night practice. That was huge.
Pretty amazing stuff. At what point did you feel confident that this was actually going to come through?
Probably Wednesday morning. I think, you know, when we found out the thing had touched down in Atlanta and cleared customs Tuesday night, a big weight was lifted off. But, you know, for the crew, there was still a monumental task going on to get that thing prepared to go on track. And honestly, the crazy thing was that car Wednesday night, it was pretty dang good. I think I was shocked because, you know, I wasn't at the test. Jürgen Egidio were telling me, hey, you know, the car wasn't great. We had a ton of push, you know, this and that. And I drove the car and just honestly, I wasn't pushing because it's a brand new car. We don't know what we have. And dang, I was really impressed. So I think better lucky than good in a lot of cases. And I think the racing gods gave us a little bit of leniency on the handling of the car. Now, we had a couple other unfortunate, you know, things with, you know, like engine and some cabling mechanical stuff that we had to swap the engine after Wednesday night practice. But the crew, again, jumped on it. They were able to make it happen. And honestly, it was a great car.
And to come away then after all of this with a podium finish and, like you said, be able to extend that championship lead just a little bit, that has to feel as good as just about any win, right, after everything that you guys went through?
I mean, if you just took away all the drama leading up to it aside, if you would have sat us down and said, okay, what are our goals going into Sebring, this 8-hour or 1,000-mile race with the WEC? Okay, our goal is to maintain our points lead. You know, never mind anything about extending it. That's always, you know, nice. But what are our goals? It's to complete the race and put ourselves in a position to carry the championship lead into the next two rounds. So to extend, to have a podium and all these other things come down the pipe is really pretty cool. So definitely exceeds expectations. And then, you know, just being able to have a result for the guys who, through, you know, blood, sweat, and tears, were able to put another car on track, that's just icing on the cake.
Two races left in the super season, of course, one being double points at Le Mans. But have you allowed yourself to start to think about what it might mean if you were able to seal the deal in June?
A little bit. And I think a lot of that, you know, is just about staying focused for the Spa race. I think, I don't know if Le Mans is actually double points. I thought it was like 35 or something like that. So maybe not quite double, but pretty close. And I think as long as we're in a position where we can, you know, start, get our minimum drive time and then kind of seal the deal at Le Mans, you know, never mind wrapping it up before we get there. But, you know, just giving ourselves the opportunity to go start the race and then know that in the back of our heads, hey, whatever we get out of Le Mans is going to be, you know, a bonus to winning the championship. I think that's the best case right now. But then I've, you know, had limited thoughts about it. The cool thing from my standpoint is, as far as we know, there's only going to be one super season. So to have that on the mantle, like, hey, we were the champions of the only, you know, kind of year and a half of racing at this level would be pretty cool. Would definitely like to get one more win if possible in these last two races, because, hey, you know, we want that top spot. And I think we have a good shot at that. So it just depends if we can do that. But you know, ultimate goal, though, just secure the championship.
Outstanding. Well, switching gears just a little bit, I spoke with you back at Daytona, I believe, about the expansion of Park Place Motorsports. I think IMSA fans are familiar with what you've done first in the GTD class and then also with GT3 Cup going back to last year. But it seems to have expanded even further, running the Volt car both in Michelin Pilot Challenge and also in SRO America's Pirelli GT4 America. And Trent Hedman and Alan Brynjolfsson have had a really remarkable start to their season. So how gratifying has it been for you to see this expansion and not just see the expansion, but also to see the success that has come with it?
No, I mean, I couldn't be happier with what's going on with Volt Racing running under our umbrella. We've got two great drivers. First of all, Alan is a blast to hang out with. So if, for anyone that hasn't met him or gotten to spend some time with him, definitely, you know, look him up around the paddock. He's a good time. His wife, Trish, also. So it's great just having them under the tent. You know, it brings a lot of fun to what we're doing. Trent, you can obviously see a little special talent that's been budding for a while, but really, you know, blossoming. Obviously, he's racing in GTD as well with the Meyer Shank crew. But I mean, I'm really impressed by what I'm seeing in this Porsche Cayman that he's doing for us. He is he's the real deal. He will definitely, you know, mark my words, he will get a race win in that car under our tent this year. And I'm going to be right there cheering like heck when it happens. Hopefully it doesn't happen at Mid-Ohio when I'm in Spa, but I'm pretty excited for that program. It's kind of like the shiny new thing, you know, that you have and get to play with. I mean, except I don't get to play with that. I just get to, you know, cheer it on. And look, last year with the Cup program, I had a lot of fun. Let me put it that way. I had a lot of fun just watching and kind of supporting a program, almost as much fun as I have driving. So I think for me, that's a direction I want to push the program. Mike Johnson, the inclusion of him up into the race, you know, operations director, that was a big key to making this happen and a big push as far as our organizational structure, covering the logistics of what's involved. Because as you said, it was like four race weekends in a row, basically.
Yeah.
So it's a big part of it. And look, we have the capability. We've known we've had the capability. It's just about doing it and opening our doors to people that are looking for support.
And the other big step for you is being one of the two teams nominated to run the Porsche factory entry effectively at the California 8 Hours at the end of the month. How did that come about, and what does it mean for your team to be singled out effectively by Porsche along with Wright Motorsports to run three factory drivers in the Intercontinental GT Challenge race?
Yeah, so look, I mean, I got to say, I didn't really have anything to do with that. And then, you know, I'm not that I'm completely removed, but the day-to-day operation stuff is all Mike. And Porsche was smart enough to ring his phone instead of mine because they could answer right away. And, you know, Mike explained that, hey, we can do this. I think Porsche had other plans with other teams to run that car or that entry. And I think, first of all, this new GT3R it's a pretty, let's say, technologically advanced car. It's a little different than the old GT3R. So as teams wrap their head around it, I think we were in a, let's say, a slightly better position to support Porsche's effort at the 8 hour than maybe another team that was going to go do it. So kind of it was a case of we were just standing there, you know, hat in hand, ready to go. And Porsche said, hey, could you do this? And we said, yeah, sure. So not like it was, I'm sure it was more well-crafted than that. I wasn't exactly in the position of making that deal, but Mike Johnson and Porsche Motorsport North America were able to do it.
Well, in any event, it's great to see. Patrick, congratulations on all the success. The recovery at Sebring was remarkable. Really cool to get to see that, and really appreciate you taking a little time to join us here and update on us on all your different projects. It's a busy time for you, but the success has to help make that commitment feel worthwhile.
Yeah, there's a lot going on, and look, I'm just happy to ride the coattails of a really good crew on both sides. You know, from WEC to our GT3R program to the Cayman GT4 program, and of course, you know, Porsche, who develops really terrific cars. So I think my next step is just going to be showing up to the race, drinking a beer and smoking a cigar, or having fun watching the cars go around. So that's the day I'm really looking forward to. So I think we'll be on a big push to get there.
Hi, I'm Jerome Liekemolen, and you're listening to Sports Car 365 Double Stint Podcast.
Back on Double Stint, Dan back with me now as we get to some listener questions. These came in using the comment section on our last podcast and also using the hashtag AskDoubleStint on Twitter. The first one comes from @PorscheZombie, who wants to know, any reason that the GTLM Porsches had such a terrible start in the IMSA race Saturday at the 12 Hours of Sebring?
Yeah, it was one of the real mysteries post-race of the 12 Hours of Sebring. Porsche ended up winning, but earlier in the race, the 911 RSRs were some 7 or 8 seconds off the pace in the heavy rain that no doubt drenched most of the spectators who were in attendance. But they managed to stage a fight back, but we asked a few of the personnel after the race where they think that lack of speed came from in the early stages, and they're not too sure. Nick Tandy had held a sort of group forum of the English media after he produced the winning drive in the 12 hours, and he said that the tyres that they use for the rain weather racing in IMSA are different to the ones in WEC, and for some reason they just can't get the IMSA wet tyres turned on. I spoke to Pascal Zurlinden after the race. He's the director of Porsche GT Motorsport, and he said to me that when we went to Sebring, we were confident. We thought we'd learned our lessons from Daytona, where the pace was low in the rain as well. But it turns out that they didn't. I think they surprised themselves with how slow the cars were in those conditions. I'm convinced that it's something to do with the tyres. I think it's the clearest reason we can give for the pace being off. If you look at the WEC and IMSA races over the Sebring weekend, both of them had some form of rain. It was slightly heavier in the IMSA race, granted, but they saw similar conditions. And in the WEC race, the Porsche seemed capable of sticking with the rest of the GTE Pro Pack, and it ended up winning, as did the Project One car in GTE Am. Whereas in IMSA, it was sort of the opposite, and then Porsche had to come back when the rain subsided. But certainly, so I think that's probably the main reason we can get. But yeah, it was a really strange scenario, and Porsche will certainly be doing a lot of head scratching in the build up to the next few races. I doubt it's going to be wet at Long Beach. You never know, but certainly for some of the races later in the year, where we're likely to get a bit of a shower, it could crop up again.
Hopefully they got that squared away. It's so strange watching Porsche struggle in the wet. That's so counter to their pedigree, but that's certainly the way it's played out in the first two rounds of the WeatherTech Championship season so far. Got another Porsche question coming from Masked Racer, who wants to know what the status of the Porsche GTLM team's livery plans are going forward. Will they go back to factory colors or stick with Brumos? I think I can field that one pretty quickly. From what I've been told, the Brumos liveries were for Daytona and Sebring only, and they'll be reverting back to the factory livery in the future. But good to see it go out with a nice win, and certainly a popular livery. I picked up a poster, actually, of the new car sporting the new livery side-by-side with an old one, one of the old Brumos Porsches, and I've got that proudly displayed on my wall at home. I think it was pretty sharp and one that we're going to remember for quite a while. Our next question comes from Matt, who wants to know, by any chance, do you have any word on any rumors about who the second and third manufacturer Stefan Rattel has mentioned for the GT2 concept? We know that Porsche has already committed to that, and we'll see them with their GT2 concept rolling out with a race during the Spa weekend for the Spa 24. But how about the second and third manufacturers? Have you heard anything, Dan?
I have, but I'm not sure what we can say just yet. I would say in response to that question, though, keep an eye on Sports Car 365, because we're hearing that one or two manufacturers might be interested. And a little surprise in there, I think, as well, a manufacturer that we might not have expected to come forth in this category, at least. But certainly, Porsche is the only one that's really activated its presence in the GT2 category, but that doesn't mean that other manufacturers are not looking at it entirely. We know that Lamborghini was at least interested in forming something roughly loosely based on its Supercar car, and that's sort of all gone a bit quiet now, but that, you know, because a manufacturer hasn't formally committed doesn't mean it's not looking. So I'm fairly confident that GT2 we're going to see have a few more manufacturer names out there, and certainly have some mixed grids fairly soon.
All right, thanks to everyone for all the questions. We do appreciate it. And if you have a question for our show next week, you can use the hashtag AskDoubleStint or leave a comment in the comment section from this week's show. Finally, Dan, let's preview the California 8 Hours coming up this weekend. We're expecting a smaller entry list, although the official entry list has not come out as we're recording this on Monday morning. That said, a couple of the manufacturers have made some announcements, and we do know a few of the driver lineups, and there certainly are some interesting names that are popping up. What's caught your attention?
Yeah, plenty of things have caught my attention, actually. It looks like, while, as you said, it's going to be a slightly smaller overall grid, the GT3 quality is actually looking really high. I mean, it, as an Intercontinental GT Challenge round, this California 8 Hours is really testament to the growth of IGTC with some of the lineups we've got. The ones that have really drawn my attention are the Straka and Gruppe M Mercedes factory backed lineups. There's just some fantastic names in there. Christina Nielsen and Gary Paffett coming into Straka Racing to drive two of their Mercedes AMG GT3s. I think those are some really interesting additions. And Nielsen, of course, knows Laguna like the back of her hand. She's raced there plenty of times in GTD. Not in a Mercedes, though, I don't think. So that's going to be interesting to see how she adapts. But for sure, there are some really good drivers across those lineups. I mean, also in the Gruppe M side of the Mercedes garage, you've also got the full season lineup of Raffaele Marcello, Maximilian Goetz, and Maximilian Buch. I mean, you can't get more textbook GT3 star driver lineup quality than that. And there's also one with Jelmer Berman, Lucas Stoltz, and Mauro Engel. So those are really, really attracting my attention. The Audis as well, though. Audi's got two lineups, six factory drivers across the board there. We also recently heard of Bentley's driver situation for the California 8 Hours, and we'll see the debuts of Lucas Ordóñez and Marcus Pautela in the Bentley N Sport factory lineup. But Ordóñez obviously was former Nissan GT3 driver who departed the manufacturer just at the start of this calendar year and is now pursuing the Bentley front, and he will share the number 108 Bentley with Paltola and Maxime Soule, which I think is a cracking lineup there. And Bentley's also got Stephen Kane, Jordan Pepper and Jules Gounon in the other car. They've just confirmed it. So as that sort of that brief roundup, not even all of the manufacturers there, but that brief roundup sort of suggests that it's certainly a high quality affair, plenty of works, interest, and certainly it's going to be another cracking round, even if the overall entry list isn't quite up to the numerical capacity that had at Bathurst.
Yeah, no doubt. And one piece of news that came in just before we started recording, it was announced that Alex Buncombe was going to be replacing Tsugio Matsuda for KCMG in that lineup as Nissan makes its trip to the California 8 Hours. So that's kind of exciting as well. To me, the big question is going to be, can this date on the calendar work? I think the smaller entry list we're seeing is in large part due to the fact that it falls instead of at the end of the sports car racing season, as it has in previous years here in North America, very much right in the middle and during a very busy time. So it's hard to draw one-offs from either IMSA or SRO America competition, and whether or not they can find a way to make this work on the calendar at this time of the year, I have some questions, and we'll have to see what the response is from a fan turnout perspective and what the teams are saying as well moving forward. But the other question for me is, in terms of the Intercontinental GT Challenge, can Audi rebound? They had a terrible outing on the mountain at Mount Panorama at Bathurst. This is a track that they have done very well at in the past, going back to the previous iterations of this race. They're loaded for bear, as we heard, certainly, as you went through their driver lineup situation. What do you think, Dan? Is this one where Audi can get back on their horse? They're very much the kings of Intercontinental GT Challenge in this young history of the championship, and I know they take a lot of pride in what they've accomplished in the series.
I think they have to bounce back here, really. I mean, it was points-wise, it was a really disappointing showing from Audi. I think they took away 3 points at Bathurst, which, you know, for the manufacturer of Audi's high standards, that's going to be that's going to be nowhere near what they were expecting to accumulate. So certainly a lot of catching up to do. And at this stage in the season in RGTC, we've only got 5 races in total, 4 races remaining, really, even though Laguna Seca is going to be round 2. So if they're going to recover, they're going to have to recover pretty quickly. Otherwise, they're going to leave themselves with too much of a task at Kyalami, the season closer. So, but if they're going to need a top result, and if they're going to need a 1-2 or a Poland victory or whatever it may be, I think Laguna Seca, the California 8 Hours, is the right place and venue and event for them to do that. Audi won. They won there last year. It seems to always perform well at Laguna Seca, and so Audi's won there last year and in 2017. So I mean, it's won every single edition of the California 8 Hours that's run so far. So you would expect the R8 LMS GT3 Evos to follow on nicely from what the standard edition R8 managed in the last couple of events we've had there. That said, IGTC is certainly growing at a phenomenal rate, and we've got so many more manufacturers involved now that it's even harder for a single one to stand out from the pack. So it's not going to be as straightforward as it might have seemed in the last couple of editions for Audi to get the top result here that they really do need if they want to bag that manufacturer's title and be in with a shout at the end of the season.
Well, it should be a fun weekend. John will be there for Sports Car 365 coverage. I'm sure I'll be pitching in a little bit, but I'll be on site for TV duties. Really looking forward to everything that is coming up with the California 8 Hours at WeatherTech Raceway Laguna Seca this weekend. Big thanks to Dan for pinch hitting here on the show this week. Thanks for joining us as well. Also like to say thank you to Patrick Lindsay for taking some time out of his schedule to do the interview with us. Hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. I thought he had some interesting stories. Nevertheless, I think that's going to be it for us on the show this week. We'd love a rating and a review on iTunes if you have the time. If you've got questions, leave them in the comment section or use the hashtag AskDoubleStint. And in the meantime, you can listen to the Daily Digest for the latest headlines from SportsCar365.com straight to you. Talk to you next week with our next edition of the Double Stint Podcast.